Hi, it's Mike. It's Saturday. It's the Saturday show. Did you have a good week? I had kind of a crazy week. We got guys next door doing construction. They're pouring concrete over my wife's head. It's a long story. Maybe I'll get into it. Play some clips from a ULERP meeting. But enough about ULERP. Do you know ULERP? It's a somewhat arcane New York City building code that has overtaken my life. But you know what else has really ensorcelled me? National Public Radio. I worked there for 10 years, and then I didn't work there for 10 years. It's almost equally divided. And that, my friends, is my professional life. The life of NPR is on trial, it would seem. They have a new CEO. Some of her tweets, some of her statements have been unearthed. She seems to be not a giant fan of truth as I see it, though, you know, a spiel, actually it was a beginning of a show I did the other day, gets into this in more detail, and we will play some of that. We're also going to play for you, you know how we do, one from the week and one from the vault. I'm just going to give you something new, because I love you very much. Damon Linker writes the Notes from the Middle Ground Substack, which he describes as an analysis and criticism of the anti-liberal right, social justice, progressivism, and cultural topics. He has also recently penned a guest essay for the opinion page of the New York Times titled, Why is Biden Struggling? Because America is Broken. Damon Linker up next. Heard, you may have seen that the incoming CEO, actually she's new, she's in place now, Catherine Marr, CEO of NPR, has a series of tweets that are up. In one, she, I'll quote it, had a dream where Kamala Harris, were on a road trip in an unspecified location, sampling and comparing nuts and baklava from roadside stands. She dreamt of eating nuts and baklava with Kamala Harris. I have to admit, I used to have dreams of eating black licorice with former Undersecretary of the Treasury Stuart Eisenstadt. And I can't emphasize this enough. It was sensuous, not sensual. Okay. Everyone has their tweets that maybe they'd like to take back. You know, in 2017, Catherine Marr bragged post-Thanksgiving, made it through dinner, zero turkeys sacrificed to the racist uncles. She then clarified, I don't really have racist uncles. It's just such a good gag. How could you not say this? When the discussion was, should we punch Nazis? She said, yes. I don't get this. Pretty sure my grandpa's marching orders were go punch Nazis and defend liberal democracy. She has tweeted that you should always trust structural privilege to show itself. Back in 2009, I mean, she was a Hillary supporter. She was a Biden supporter. Back in 2011, she wrote, with Elizabeth Warren running, there's finally a chance for Dems to get excited about 2012. I have a question. Who do the critics of Catherine Marr think the NPR listener is? The NPR listener is that. She's embodying them. She's like every progressive 40-year-old white woman who worked at or in fact headed a foundation. And if you're saying, wait, maybe there's some, okay, a tech foundation. She got paid hundreds of thousands of dollars in the nonprofit sector. Wikicommons was her gig. That person is always going to have a Black Lives Matter sign in her window, as she does. She's going to criticize the New York Times for running the James Bennett op-ed, as she did. She's going to give us the quotes that we all know that everyone gives. Quote, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. She said, quoting Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who she needed to tell us, Moynihan was a racist in his own liberal way, but even a broken clock is right twice a day. She is also, quote, so done with late-stage capitalism. But you know what I say? I say, fine. This is obviously the kind of person who is very much understanding of what the NPR listener wants. She's the NPR listener. And even now, though NPR is experiencing some tsuris, as they say, from the Free Press essay by former editor, and my former editor in part, Uri Berliner, this Catherine Marr thing, I don't know if it's a sideshow. It does exemplify what NPR is. NPR has clarified, and this is true, the CEO doesn't have a part in news content. Of course, she's the CEO. She has higher fireability of the people who decide the news direction of the network. NPR has also said, and she has also said, when I was a private citizen, I was a private citizen. We're going to make NPR fair. But what is fair? Or, to quote a question that Catherine Marr was asking, what is truth?
That perhaps for our most tricky disagreements, seeking the truth and seeking to convince others of the truth might not be the right place to start. In fact, our reverence for the truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding common ground.
This is also within the mindset, within the progressive, structural racism, late capitalism, quoting non-incredibly in-depth recitation of slogans, within that mindset, the what is truth? Whose truth is it question is very popular. The reason that sounds like it's about as deep as a TED Talk is it's literally from a TED Talk. She went on and did some more questioning of truth.
I'm certain that the truth exists for you and probably for the person sitting next to you. But this may not be the same truth. This is because the truth of the matter is very often, for many people, what happens when we merge facts about the world with our beliefs about the world. So we all have different truths.
And I guess that's fine, or has the patina of being fine, if what you're running is an activist collective or a pressure group, but not a news organization. Reverence for the truth is really important. And I'm sure she'd say, okay, that was in my old job where I got to do TED Talks and speak with a mellifluousness and everyone would nod along because they weren't thinking too deeply about the subjects at play. And it's also a fairly horrible thing to endorse in the age of Donald Trump denying and destroying the truth. So that was, I always say that the one thing that saved us from total postmodernism in around 2020 was the fact that a full embrace of that would have played exactly into Donald Trump's hands. So as everyone who posted in this house Science Matters signs on their lawn was asking so chin-strokingly, what is truth? A good rebuttal would be, well, it's not what Donald Trump said, and we could all agree with that. Here, for me, for my journalism, for what I look for, I don't think about the what is truth as the guiding light and the way forward. It is true that we all come to the world with different perspectives, and we should also be open to our own perspectives being changed. But it's also true that our newspapers, our news organizations, our arbiters of fact, our arbiters of truth should forthrightly be in the truth game. And this is why better quotes beyond what is truth are quotes like Woodward and Bernstein. Woodward always says, what we do in journalism is the best attainable version of the truth. Not just facts, but of the truth. It's not a recitation of this thing happened and that thing happened. It's to put it in a truthful context. Marty Baron also said, we go to work, we don't go to war, when the Trump administration was impending. And A.G. Sulzberger, to pick a guy of a generation and a half younger than those two, who runs the New York Times, he knew that postmodernism and a what is truth default was destroying his paper. And he wrote a big piece in the Columbia Journalism Review. It's long. I loved it. It didn't get a lot of attention, I guess, in the world beyond journalism nerds. But he essentially backed the idea of objectivity. He was smart enough to know you couldn't endorse the word of objectivity, but having objectivity be a sort of guiding light, a North Star for you, has done journalism well for the last 80 years. And if you were to say, what about activism? That can actually exist within the world of objectivity. Ida B. Wells is not a rebuke of what objective journalism can be. Ida B. Wells exists within the tradition of journalism that allows for objectivity. So Sulzberger, he called it independence journalism because he knows you can't say objectivity. That should be the way that our media is going. Thankfully, it is the way that the New York Times is trending. It is not the way that at least this CEO, who we are assured will have no impact on content, so let's hire her, that is not the way that the CEO, at least her track record, has indicated what she believes. If you want to, I'll ask you, do you want to hear me talk more about the Uri Berliner Free Press essay? Do you want, or is this too, look, we know it, we enjoy the puns, and we like the occasional conversation with the guy who writes for the Family Guy, and maybe a little less Israel Mike. But if you want me to get into it, I can. I guess I'm taking requests. Also, in general, leave a review. I never say this enough. Leave a review on, people say a 5-star review. Leave as many stars you want on iTunes. Thanks a lot. There are a couple of phrases that apply to Damon Linker that I warn you undersell the sheer intellectual excitement I derive from engaging with his work. Some of these words are moderate, centrist, calm, sane, political scientist. But seriously, Damon Linker is great. He's smart. I've been meaning to have him on for some time. Guess what? It would be odd if he weren't here after that buildup. But he is. Hello, Damon. Welcome to The Gist.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So let's talk brokenism. Let's start right off. I had Alana Newhouse, friend of mine, on the show, and we talked about her concept, which is just essentially, look around. There are so many systems that are not working for people. It sprang from a personal experience she had with healthcare and her child. But you wrote about this in the New York Times, and you applied it to discontent with Joe Biden. Expound a bit, if you will.
Sure. Well, what I was trying to do is answer this riddle that has been plaguing, I think, a lot of pundits, which is, you know, the economy seems to be doing well. Growth is up. Unemployment's down. We had inflation, sure, but now that's gone back down. It's a little higher than it was before, but it's, you know, not. It's not like late 70s inflation or anything. And so the big mystery is, why is Biden struggling? Why is he stuck under 40% approval? Why can't he pull ahead of Trump at all? He basically trails Trump in national polls to tying him. That's about as good as he does. He's behind in a lot of swing states. What accounts for this when we lived through Trump and a lot of people dislike him? So my attempt to explain this is to dig into some polls, a lot of them long-standing polls that measure things like the satisfaction of Americans with the way things are going, right track, wrong track for the country. Do you have confidence in American institutions or trust in institutions? And all of these have been trending negative for years, sometimes for decades.
Yeah. When was the last time right track, wrong track said right track? Like a little
I don't know offhand, but it's been a long time. And especially the one that I spent most of my time on, the satisfaction survey, which, you know, basically was bouncing around between like 40 and 60 something percent through the Bush administration. And then it started to capsize halfway through Bush in like 2004, when there were no weapons of mass destruction found and the insurgency started up there. Then it hit a kind of all-time low by the time we got to the end of Bush with the financial crisis and all of the scariness of that moment. And it very then slowly tracked back up through the entire Obama administration and hit a peak post-2004 peak, still below what it was before that. On the eve of the pandemic, of you know, it, like, that was kind of the high point. Literally, February 2020 was the post-2004 peak. And then, of course, with COVID and the lockdowns.
Yeah, and by the way, this peak was still under
50%. Yeah, it was. It was still in the 40s. So it was still not up to what it used to be, but it was very slowly recovering. And then with COVID, it capsized again. It then went up a little bit early under Biden, but then went down again once the inflation and the withdrawal from Afghanistan took place. And so basically we're stuck in these doldrums where a lot of Americans of all kinds, I mean, we're talking now something like 75% of Americans are dissatisfied with how things are going. That cuts across both parties. So it's a general free-floating blah.
But isn't citing these, so many thoughts, but one is this, citing the overall dissatisfaction, why isn't this applying a social explanation to a political problem?
Well, it sort of is, but you can't. I mean, you can analytically separate out things like economics and society and culture and politics, but they all inform each other in our lives. So, like, people's mood, like, people kept talking about, like, why do people hate Biden? Inflation is getting better. Why is the vibe so bad? And there are a lot of people I respect and learn from all the time, like Matt Iglesias and other kind of center-left policy wonk types get really frustrated at this because they're like, look, the fact is things are good. The vibe is wrong. We have to tell people why they're wrong and it's actually great. My attitude is, that's not how you do well in politics. No one ever won an election by explaining to the voters why they were wrong to be pissed about what they're pissed about. You have to meet them where they are, even if behind the scenes, we policy intellectuals look at the data and are like, This is like, we're all just a bunch of big babies. If the economy had been like this in 1978, Carter would have won re-election in a landslide. Grow up. We might feel that way. Maybe there's something to that. But as a, you know, on the stump, on the political hustings, you can't win that way. You have to meet people where they are.
It's very hard for someone who's been in office for 4 years, or in the case of Joe Biden, you point this out, as an institutionalist and has been deeply embedded in our institutions, which you diagnose as broken, very hard specifically for that person to make the point, therefore vote for me. I have diagnosed the problem, because the obvious counter argument is you are deeply entrenched in the problem. You've had many, many years to address the problem. So just acknowledging the problem, seeking re-election, is a little bit farcical.
Yeah, I agree. It's a challenge. But I also think kind of rank and file average Americans who don't devote their lives to studying politics like you and I do respond positively to expressions of authenticity and honesty. And Biden, I think, in the scheme of politicians, has always been pretty good at that, mm-hmm. that kind of folksy Scranton guy persona that he's cultivated. He speaks like an average guy, average Joe, if you will. And if he just came out and he said something like, you know what, I understand that my approval rating first went really south in the withdrawal from Afghanistan. I admit it could have gone a little bit better maybe, but you know what? I went ahead with the withdrawal because I knew that we were muddling through there, not making a positive difference, and I knew that that was one of the problems we needed to address and get out. It would have been very difficult, if not impossible, for anyone to get out there without it being somewhat of a mess, but I did what needed to be done, and we all have to be honest in that way and recognize when something isn't working. It had been 20 years, and it was time to move on and focus on the other challenges that are happening in the world, like Ukraine and Russia, like China, like the Middle East. And now we're freed up to do that because we don't have a few thousand soldiers in Afghanistan and needing to supply them and keep the lid on a Taliban insurgency there going into the third decade.
Yeah, I don't think the Joe Biden, I think you probably agree, the Joe Biden of 2024 is much less well-equipped to do that than the Joe Biden of years past. And I do think that there is a niche for the happy warrior type who oversees an economy that still has challenges. And, you know, FDR knew how to speak about this. And certainly Clinton, although during his reelection, he glided through because things were just things were good and people were feeling them as good. But my question, I got a couple questions about perception. But first, is it harder than the happy warriors, let's put Reagan there, the optimist who says, yes, we have challenges and things aren't perfect, but we're on the right path. Is it harder for that person to make that argument if the party of that person, and even in that person's public declarations, is the thesis that America is inherently a fill-in-the-blank, a racist society, a sexist society, a fundamentally, structurally, popular word they use, flawed society. It seems, yeah, you and I can understand how to navigate that, but I think it would play to a lot of people as these people aren't optimistic about America. These people, or at least many members of his party, are in a tear-it-all-down mode.
Well, that's certainly true about the leftward faction of the party, which has like an outsized voice in our culture because they control a lot of or have a lot of influence in a lot of elite institutions that have the megaphone of social media and other prominent influential positions. But Biden has never really been from that faction of the party. He, I think, should be running as like average Joe, who like occasionally will like say the so-called wrong term and like stumble into it and not apologize. Like when he referred to an undocumented immigrant at the State of the Union just off the cuff in one of his responses to, I think, Marjorie Taylor Greene there in the Congress, he called that person an illegal. Like, and then he apologized a couple days later. That was stupid. Like he not that he should go out and every day talk about goddamn those illegals, but if he occasionally quote, misspeaks by the standards of what the kind of the woke side of the party insists is the required language, he should just brush it off and be like, whatever, Americans know what I meant. It's no big deal.
You know, he all but said that. Like, I don't know if you can recall his interview that he did after that. It was like, well, obviously I shouldn't have said that. I should have said this. But my major point is, and if you listen to that interview, I think a person of good faith would get it. But
yeah,
it's very hard in this environment. I don't know. I do know. I do believe that Joe Biden doesn't have those rhetorical skills anymore. And I think the people around him just don't let him do interviews and are so protecting him from either making a mistake or not saying the right thing that it's impossible for him to get that more positive let's keep going on the right track, brothers and sisters type message out there.
I agree. And I even say in the piece that one of the obstacles to him doing what I say he should be doing is that in addition to being a kind of product of these broken establishment institutions, the very fact that he's the age he is and as frail as he is almost makes him like a walking exemplification of the brokenness. Like, yes, here's the man who sits atop our creaking institutional structures.
And,
you know, people will accuse me of ageism and saying that, and some have. But, you know, I still say, yeah, I bet you anything that at a subliminal level, that is one of the things that is holding him down in the polls, that people look at him and they're like, ugh, can't we do better than this? Why are we here? And you know, Trump's too. Trump, you know, with his nodding off in his trial, and he speaks word salad gibberish at his events far more than he did in 2016.
Right.
He's
gone from Waldorf to Chef.
Oh, yeah. It's just total gobbledygook comes out of his mouth. And every now and then he still has a kind of funny, snarky thing that comes out semi-coherently. So his people still eat it up. But, you know, you put them up there together, like the idea that either of them could really function in a debate. What a total exemplification of the brokenness of our political system. If you look at these two doddering old guys.
Yeah, and Trump specifically, if the idea is the RFK messaging, Trump is the worst to say, and now I can represent a new way forward, because he had a shot, and most people at that point adjudicated him not to provide any solution or adequate solution to the brokenness. Now we get to the perception problem. I think even with some sort of great ideal messenger, and whoever that is for you, it could be Buttigieg, it could be Newsom, it could be some person, it could be Gretchen Whitmer, whoever that great Democrat is who might embody the best messaging, I don't know that the 20-something percent of satisfaction goes much up to 30. And it's enough possibly to win an election. Someone has to win the election. But I think our dissatisfaction, it's a little bit about reality, but we always have had wins, right? We're talking in your piece, you talked about, you know, we're getting over the war in Iraq. Yeah, but we're getting over it. This was a supposed forever war. Our forever wars stopped. I haven't heard any acknowledgement of that. Ooh, sorry, we shouldn't have described them as such. We went through a pandemic, as did the whole world. And then the United States saved the world from the pandemic because we invented, yes, credit to a Turkish scientist, but we invented the cure. There is a lot of good stuff, as you know, if you look at so many metrics like cancer rates and communicable diseases. Things are getting so much better, but everything just feels like a bummer. So I come back to, we're living in a very different age of perception, and I gotta, in a Jonathan Haidt way, blame technology for this. And that's why I think there's a cap on what a politician can do to make people feel more satisfied. Your thoughts?
No, I think that's right. I mean, people like Iglesias spend a lot of time, and in fact, he wrote a post in response to my Times piece on brokenness by focusing, as he tends to do, on like, this is all a function of the media just like wanting clicks. And how do you get clicks? You tell people bad news. If you tell them good news, their eyes glaze over and they move on. And there's a kind of like adrenaline rush thing that happens when you see the sky is falling. And yeah. So that drives people to click, and the click brings in the profits. And so there's an incentive within the media to always lead with the bad news. That's why things happen where, like, you know, I don't know, interest rates get cut or inflation comes in a little cooler than expected, and the media report will be something like, oh, that's good, but then that might lead to this other problem. There right. always has to be a kind of pivot to, like, what's the downside to
yeah,
the upside?
Yeah, I was talking
upside.
About this on my show, this amazing report about how many fewer people were having complications, asthma, dying of coal. But then the New York Times just had to emphasize, but scientists have also discovered that the virulence of coal is much worse than was previously known, which is actually great that there's so much less coal particulate in the air. That really emphasizes what a great advancement it was. But no, it had to be framed as, but here's the horrible downside that you should never let out of your mind lest you get blasé about our anti-coal experience.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's always complicated. I remember when I worked at The Week, you know, I did opinion writing there, but we did a lot of other stuff that wasn't political. And often our highest traffic pieces there were kind of like lifestyle happy things that would get shared through yeah. Facebook and stuff. So there is a market for happy talk, but I think in some ways, both parties, I think it's an interaction then of media and the shape of the two parties. Both parties, we know, like, were divided very, very narrowly. It's, you know, a lot of Democrats like to say, oh, Democrats keep winning these elections. It's only because of the counter-majoritarian institutions like the Electoral College enables Republicans to win when they're really losing. But why are Trump and Biden as close as they are when Trump is so nuts and, like, so unappealing? Well, it's because the two parties are very closely matched in popularity. And they are like, they each antagonize a huge amount of the country. There are so many people who are just motivated by negative partisanship. The reason, I think a big reason why Biden can't get any traction is there a lot of independents who just hate the Democratic Party and don't want to see the Democratic Party have more power. Yeah. And similarly, there are a lot of Democrats who, like, want nothing more than to ensure that, like, Trump and Trumpism never gets any power. And so both of them have an incentive to always push an angle that's, look how terrible the other guys are. And then the media gets clicks by running with the story on both sides. And so the end result is that I think our kind of informational ecosystem is just totally polluted by polemics against each side. And it's all negativity all the time, because that's the only way that each party thinks it can actually prevail in the election, by making more people hate the other guy. Because they can't really make enough people like themselves.
Right. This is absolutely true. So I think smart people in each party know this, or they're acting as if they do. So what you try to do, I guess the theory is, you do the good works, you actually commit to programs and the material improvement of the citizenry during your term, and then you point to it and hope to win 55-45. That seems to me what Biden is doing, right? He has the CHIPS Act and he lowers the price of prescription drugs, and he's a bad messenger for this, and partisan polarization prevents America from even knowing about it. But the theory is, we're just going to do what we can to help people's lives improve by as much as we can, and then maybe we'll win by a little bit in the four states that are going to swing the election. Right. Do you think that, I mean, I say that's the best you can do, but do you think there's more evidence for that, or more evidence for playing into, no, we're going to make arguments to anathemize the other guy? That's the better strategy.
Well, I mean, honestly, I think we've been stuck for the last decade at least in a kind of realignment that can't be born. It like we're ready to birth a realignment that would allow one of the two parties to win by, say, as you said, 55-45. I mean, Obama was a huge win at 53. Like, we haven't been at 55 since I think the first George H.W. Bush won, you know, following Reagan, who won by 58%. Like, we're in an era where that never happens anymore. And yet, I sort of feel like, you know, all the stats that we've seen about how we're kind of depolarizing along race so that, like, increasing numbers of especially black men are entertaining voting for the Republicans, and increasing numbers of Latinos are entertaining voting for Republicans. Still, majorities vote for the Democrats, but yet the margin is declining. If that continued and you ended up with the Republicans truly becoming a party of those who do not go to college across all races, that could blow things open and you could get a 55% victory for a kind of populist Republican. I don't think Trump can do it because he's hated by so many people. And then the option for a Democrat to do that, I think, actually is to track more toward the center. If a Democratic candidate in an articulate way, someone who, say, looked and spoke like Gavin Newsom, if someone did that, and yet Newsom is very woke in a lot of the things he does because it's California, but if he ditched that and actually started to sound more like a cultural centrist and it combined it with the rest of the Democratic Party's economic agenda, I think that could be 55% for the Democrats. But in both cases, you alienate some members of your coalition, so it's very risky.
Well, I don't have to tell you.
That would be a realignment actually being born, would be some of the people who've been on one side shift to the other in a big way.
And that was Damon Linker. He writes notes from the Middle Ground Substack. So usually on Saturday, we just, not just, we give you gems from the past. I wanted to give you something new, perhaps whet your appetite for Monday. And I also want to thank, for all their hard work, the Quaint Mallards, Corey Wara, producer, Joel Patterson, senior producer, Michelle Pesca, in charge of concrete abatement, as best as anyone can be. Talk to you Monday.